Baseball PhD podcast segment to remember, 2010.
This next interview comes from episode 12, Chicago Cubs.
Farley and I interviewed best-selling author Jonathan Eig about his latest book, Get Capone, The Secret Plot to Get America's Most Wanted Gangster.
Now, you know, Capone was a Cubs fan just like me.
I know, but during Capone's lifetime, he saw the Cubs win a World Series in 1908. Hang in there, Farley, someday.
A great baseball PhD. Welcome to at least my favorite author, Jonathan Eig. And we first learned about Jonathan when we wanted to learn more about Lou Gehrig and the luckiest man. And here we are, honored in Cleveland, Ohio. And you're here now to teach us about gangsters from Chicago. And your new book is Get Capone. How long did it take you to write this great book?
This was about 3 years of work.
So just like Luckiest Man, it takes 3 hard years of work to become a best-selling author with a good idea.
That seems to be about my rhythm. I work pretty slowly. I'm heavy on the research. I can't just make this stuff up out of thin air. So it takes me a while to find all the stuff to write my books.
Was the research on Al Capone harder or easier than Lou Gehrig?
In some ways, it was easier. Gehrig didn't give a lot of interviews. He didn't talk a lot. And, you know, Babe Ruth got all the coverage. So working on Gehrig was tough until I found the letters that he wrote to his doctor that really opened up a whole new part of the story for me. But with Capone, there's a ton of material out there. He loved talking to the press. The guy was an idiot about it. He gave way too many interviews.
And that's the deep thought. He was an idiot about it because if he had been more sophisticated, he might have lived a longer, happier life.
He might have stayed out of jail a little longer, I think. You know, the smart gangsters knew that you didn't want your name in the paper. You wanted to go about your business, make your money, and try not to bring on any extra attention. But Capone thought he could be a celebrity gangster. You know, it was the 20s. Some people had the idea that it was fun to be a star, Babe Ruth, and these guys sitting on flagpoles, and Lucky Lindbergh. They had the idea that they could be a celebrity. So Capone thought, maybe I'll try that too.
Right, right.
So in this time in the 30s, there were a lot of contemporaries of Capone who didn't quite seem to make it to his level. For instance, you had Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, Bonnie and Clyde, even Harry Pierpoint. None of those guys seemed to quite elevate themselves in their professions to the status that Capone did. What made him the gangster?
Well, a big difference between Capone and the guys you mentioned is Prohibition. Those guys came along a little bit later. To get really rich, they had to rob banks. Robbing banks is a lot harder than selling beer. Capone made all of this money because beer was illegal. And so you have this multi-million dollar industry that the legitimate industries have abandoned. And he's able to take it over. And that's the main source of his income. Once he has that kind of cash, he can bribe the public officials all over Chicago and he can pretty much run the town. But these guys, you know, Dillinger, they had to always be on the run. They couldn't bribe anybody and hang around and make themselves a celebrity the way Capone did.
Go to Northwestern football games and
that's
fur coats and all that.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Let's go from one world, the Lou Gehrig world, back to Al Capone. We all know the magical date of July 4th, 1939. Lou Gehrig standing in Yankee Stadium saying that he was the luckiest man on earth. Let's go back a decade, July 4th, 1929. Would Al Capone had said he was the luckiest man at that time?
No, I think Al Capone always felt like he was getting the short end of the stick. Like, he liked being the star, but he always felt like he was being picked on. The feds were always trying to make a case against him. They were blaming him for everything. That would have been right after the Valentine's Day Massacre. And he kept saying, I had nothing to do with it. Give me a break. Why would I do something so stupid? The feds are wiretapping my phones. They're investigating my taxes. Why would I order a hit on my rival, kill 7 guys, and not even kill the guy I was supposedly after? In 1929, he was not feeling very lucky.
So if anything, he was starting to feel the heat. The end of his career was starting to end. When was he prosecuted for tax evasion?
It was 1931, the fall of 1931, and he knew it was coming. He saw it coming for a couple of years. But he thought, you know, there's a good chance he'd get 2 years, 3 years in jail and do his time like a lot of these guys were doing and come back out and still get into the business, still have some money to make.
And was Capone the first gangster to be prosecuted under the tax code?
No, he was the biggest. Actually, the guy who prosecuted Capone tried it on a few other gangsters first to see if it would work, to see if it would hold up under
appeal. And that's the famous George E.Q. Johnson.
That's right. George E.Q. Johnson is the real hero of the Capone story. It's not Elliot Ness, as we've been led to believe.
And remember, Elliot Ness, he started his career in Cleveland, so we were walking around with our chests puffed out.
That's right.
But on the Daily Show, You referred to Elliot Ness as like the Geraldo of his time.
Well, that might have been a little bit mean, a little bit unfair.
That might have been the same night the Cavs lost, too.
Oh, so I'm going to...
You're jinxing us.
I'm going to have a hard time here in Cleveland. No, the problem with Elliot Ness was he did his job. You know, he went out there and they asked him to go investigate Capone's brothels, his bars, his breweries, and he disrupted the operation a little bit. The problem with Ness was that he never came up with any evidence that was strong enough to use against Capone. He could never prove that
convict him. He could only annoy him.
That's right, exactly. He was a sort of a fly in Capone's ointment. And I don't think Capone ever really knew Elliot Ness's name. I don't think he'd ever got to that level. So Ness talks
so
a good game.
So if we brought Al Capone back from heaven or hell and made him watch some DVDs of The Untouchables,
he'd laugh his ass off.
He would say, when did this happen?
That's right. Elliot Ness would watch The Untouchables and laugh his ass off and say, this never happened either.
Wow. So Al Capone gets convicted in 1931.
Right.
The feds were willing to do a plea bargain of two and a half years. The judge. Who was the judge that says not enough?
The judge is James H. Wilkerson. There's another good connection here to Lou Gehrig and Jackie Robinson. James H. Wilkerson was the federal judge who replaced Kennesaw Mountain Landis on the bench. So
a baseball commissioner
threw
the book at Al Capone.
The guy who replaced the baseball commissioner threw the book at Al Capone. And he takes this deal that Capone has agreed to. Feds have agreed to it. Everybody all the way up to the president has agreed on this deal. 2.5 years for Al Capone. The judge takes it at the last minute, throws it out.
Well, that shows you the power of a lifetime appointment as a federal judge.
That's right.
Because only a federal judge could salute the president and say, I'm not going to do what you want to do.
That's right. Although I suspect that Hoover, President Hoover, was whispering in his ear. I suspect that the judge was actually carrying out the orders of the president, but that Hoover didn't leave his fingerprints on the job. He wanted to see, he would have, after all the work that the feds had put in, after all Hoover had riding on this, for Capone to get two and a half years and to laugh about it and say, I beat the system again, was just too much for Hoover to take.
Wow, so you do think that Hoover wanted the 11 years.
I do.
All right, so now Al Capone gets convicted, and now he gets to go to the left coast. They
right.
send him to San Francisco and then put him on a ferry and say, now you're going to Alcatraz.
That's right.
Now, Alcatraz was like a boutique prison, correct? 200 inmates, something like that?
Yeah, it was a sweet deal. No, it was a pretty tough place. It was actually – he was in the first batch of prisoners ever sent to Alcatraz. And the reason they sent Capone there was because they wanted a lot of publicity. They
right.
wanted to show Americans that this was the place they were going to get tough on crime again. You know, it's all about public relations. And Capone becomes a scapegoat again, a symbol
right.
where they're able to say to criminals, this is what you get if you screw with the law like Al Capone did. We're going to send you to Alcatraz.
Now, once he got to Alcatraz – was he a leader of the inmates, or was he a tired Italian gentleman who just wants to be left alone?
No, he was a model prisoner. He got into no trouble. Part of the problem for him was that he was very sick. He had syphilis, and it was in this tertiary stage, now affecting his brain. And there were moments when he was clear and his thinking was fine, and he wrote these nice letters to his son and to his mother and to his wife. But there were other moments when he was a raving lunatic and his brain was just frying.
Wow. And that's probably the main reason that the feds let him leave prison early. He did not serve his 11 years.
That's right. He got off for good behavior. He only served 8 years. And by the time he got out, he was wasted. There was no chance of him committing more crimes.
And just to show you how people are aging today, Farley, how old was Capone when he left prison?
He was 40.
40?
Yeah.
And the poor guy got to live for a few more years?
Yeah, he lived until 47. And, you know, he was at the peak in his career when he was only 27, 28 years old. And by the time he was 30, 32, he was done. His career was over. So the rise and fall of Al Capone was really pretty brief.
It was brief, and he was a shooting star, kind of like a professional athlete, you know, hitting full stride, 25, 26. And
that's
it's
right.
like, are you going to be depressed when you're 40? And that's exactly what happened to Al Capone.
That's right.
In closing, what was the biggest thing that you learned about Al Capone when you said, boy, I never knew that? That really surprises me.
There were so many things, but I think, first of all, the fact that he didn't commit the Valentine's Day Massacre,
right.
and I found evidence to suggest who did, that was pretty amazing to me. And I think on a sort of a macro level, I was surprised at what a reasonable guy he sounded like in all these interviews he gave. I think he was not a psychopath. I think he was actually a fairly complicated guy who could kill when he had to. I mean, he grew up, learning how to be tough, but he also knew how to keep a business going. To stay in business as long as he did, he must have had some brains as well.
Right. Last question. The thugs of today or the thugs of the 20s? Who was more vicious and sophisticated?
Oh, I would much prefer to have to handle the thugs of yesterday. I think today's drug dealers and
they're worse.
I think they're way worse.
This has been a Baseball PhD production. Copyright 2010.